Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people. My guest today, believe it or not, is Michael K. Stone, not Michael D. Stone. He's the primary author, senior editor at the Center for Eco-Literacy. He co-edited Ecological Literacy, Educating Our Children for a Sustainable World, and was the managing editor of the Whole Earth magazine and Millennium Whole Earth Catalog. Michael's written for numerous publications, including the New York Times, Toronto Star, and served on the staff of the Lieutenant Governor of Illinois and the Illinois Arts Council. Thanks so much for joining us today, Michael.
I'm delighted to be with you.
It's great to have you on. You have a good name.
I'm proud of it.
Well, let's start by talking about the Center for Eco-Literacy. Can you give us a little background? You've been around about 20 years now, but in some circles you're not that well known.
Right. The Center for Eco-Literacy evolved from something called the Elmwood Institute, which Fritjof Capra and Joanna Macy and various other people were part of, which was largely an ecological think tank. And then in the mid-90s, decided they wanted not only to keep thinking, of course, but also to begin to be involved in more practical pursuits. And so they created a couple of wings, and one of them became the Center for Eco-Literacy, concerned with K through 12 education. So since then, the center has worked to, our mission is education for sustainable living, and it's worked to support schools in a variety of ways. We offer seminars, we do consulting, various kinds of publications, such as Smart by Nature, which we're talking about today. We just did the film Food Inc. We just did a
great film. Yeah. I really did enjoy. Enjoy may not be the right word, but it's one of those films everyone needs to see.
Right. And we just did a teacher's guide for that, which is just available and is available on the website now, downloadable, largely for high school and above, but it's an attempt to take that film and begin to talk about what kind of lessons you can teach from it, what students can learn, how they can use the film as a way to think better about the issues that are important. So we do that kind of work. We do two or three seminars a year. We attract people, it turns out, from across the country, and last when we did, I think we had 9 countries represented. So we do that kind of work, and then one of the things that, as I mentioned, that we're doing is trying to document the work that people are doing all across the country in what we're calling schooling for sustainability.
You know, a lot of people, Michael, would say that our education system, particularly K through 12, mm-hmm. is severely broken. I know some people that say it just needs to fall apart. Mm-hmm. For many reasons, from tenure to, the feeling that our education system has been a production line for small consumers. You don't have that same point of view, though. From reading your book, I see you feel that this is something that can be fixed, and you're doing some amazing work. But let's start out with looking at what's the current state of K through 12 education in the United States from your perspective?
Well, I think that I certainly understand broken as an adjective that people would want to use. What we're trying to do is to highlight the good work that is being done. And so we have found, again, across the country, there are schools. Sometimes they feel isolated, which is one of the reasons we wrote the book, was that people are doing very good work and don't know about other people who are doing the same kind of work. So I think that there's a lot of energy, a lot of concern. I think there's a growing movement in trying to look at how to make public education, as well as independent education, charter schools, all of those adequate to the future. And so what we've tried to do is not so much to reach a judgment about whether it's working or not, but to find those places where it is working that can inspire other people. I think that we're A lot of what we're trying to do is to look at the ways that schools can change. And again, one of our purposes in writing the book was to show a lot of ways that people have found to change schools, a lot of ways that parents, teachers, administrators have all begun to say, well, this can be done. And so we're really trying to look at what's possible. I think there are certainly large obstacles, but we are delighted when we find people who are, in spite of all those obstacles, going to move ahead and just determine that they're going to do what needs to be done for education.
Yeah, there's a lot of very committed people that are looking at that. When you say schooling for sustainability, first of all, let's define what we mean by sustainability, and what are you saying when you're saying schooling for sustainability? That's saying a lot.
That's saying a lot, and maybe I'll work at it backwards. When we say schooling for sustainability, in this case, part of what that means, as you alluded to earlier, is that we're talking about working through schools, so that we're really talking about what work can be done in schools. There's a lot of good work outside of schools in various kinds of education, whether it's in public parks or outside of school programs or private institutions or foundations. But we're concerned about what can be done in schools, which is where most of the kids in America spend most of their day, most of the time. For sustainability, we've begun using a definition which really comes from Fritjof Capra, and that's the idea that a sustainable society is one which understands how nature works, understands how humans and nature are related, and creates its institutions, its education systems, its economies in ways that are compatible with the way the natural world actually operates and are attuned to the limitations that the natural world puts, whether it's carrying capacity or how much pollution the natural world can absorb. And so it pays attention to those and then creates its own ways of operating that are attentive to those and that respect those and that can learn from those. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that's important, I think, that we've discovered is that when we talk about schooling, we're really talking about much more than what happens in the classroom. I think we really believe that curriculum is everywhere students learn. And so they learn from the food that's served to them in the cafeteria. They learn from what the school does in its own practices about resource use, about energy. They learn from how the school makes decisions, how it involves the community or doesn't, how it relates to the people around them or not, so that all of those things put together constitute schooling for us. And what we're trying to help people see is how they can pay attention to all of those and do that in a way in which students learn lessons that are going to make them effective citizens in confronting the very real problems that we're looking at when we look at what's happening in the next decades for the country and for the world.
One of the things that we've talked about on conversations on several shows is the phenomena of nature deficit disorder, mm-hmm. and the impact, particularly in the inner cities, of which, of course, you're here in Berkeley and the Bay Area. That's a huge problem. But what you talk about is ecological intelligence. So let's travel a little bit mm-hmm. from one extreme to the other. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your sense of where people are with the nature deficit disorder and how we're moving towards ecological intelligence.
I think that nature deficit disorder is very real. I think, on the other hand, that people are finding ways to address that. And sometimes they're surprising in what you might look at as small ways, but school in Cleveland that's partly studying what's growing literally up through the asphalt, the flowers that are making their way through the asphalt, certainly school gardens, certainly something like roof gardens, habitats on campus. So we're very interested in schools that are finding ways to bring nature to the campus. We're also very interested in programs that get kids out of the building, into the natural world, because I think that everything that people have said about nature is true. I think it does heal people. It does help students learn better. But it takes some effort sometimes to get out into nature, and sometimes it takes an effort in an urban setting to find those spots of nature within the natural world, within the urban world. Another school we're looking at in Vermont, is an urban school in Vermont, made the realization that kids can learn as much from studying the squirrels in the streets where they live as they could from reading a book about an African animal or an Australian animal.
Maybe more.
Maybe more, exactly. They have much more opportunity to observe over time. They have much more observed to see how those animals strategize and what they do to make a living themselves. So we're interested in all of those kinds of ways that people can get into nature. Schools that some of the dramatic examples in the book, a school in New Jersey that was building from the ground up and decided there will be, it would happen to be next to a woods, and so they said, we're not going to build a playground. The woods is the playground. That kind of thing, places where people are rehabilitating habitats, whether that's a stream habitat near their campus, some of them literally in their backyard. Sometimes it takes going to a place where species are endangered or erosion is occurring and getting kids hands-on involved in making repairs to that. So that all of those kinds of things, I think it's something that doesn't happen automatically. And in fact, there's an automatic kind of tendency to stay within the classroom. And so a lot of what we talk about is David Orr talks about making a jailbreak from the classroom. And so that's the kind of thing we're talking about, how you can get kids into nature, whether it's exotic, faraway nature or something that's maybe a block away from the school, but helps them to see how the world works and also helps them to see the way the world works in its messiness, that to be able to understand wholly how an ecosystem works, very different from reading about an idealized version, say, in a textbook. So all of those things, I think, are important things, and we're finding schools that are finding, again, different ways to do that.
I love the whole systems approach mm-hmm. that you take, and it's so important, and it's very hard, I think, for many people still to be able to think in terms. I come from a systems mm-hmm. background mm-hmm. also, so mm-hmm. I really appreciated that about the book, that you look at all the connections
that's one of the things with a school garden or with nature, kind of compels you to look at a whole system because it exists as a whole system. It's not a carbon cycle here and nutrients there, but it all happens all the time. And really, to get deeply enough into it to understand it requires you to think systemically.
David Crow, who I had on recently, was talking about a school that they started called the Learning Garden down mm-hmm. in Southern California. Uh-huh. You're probably familiar with it. And what happens when the kids come in from the city and it's like, oh, yuck, it's mm-hmm. dirt. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that they wouldn't even eat the food because it was in the ground. And how could you eat something like that? And the amazing turnaround mm-hmm. in a year of working in the garden and all these different subjects. You have, in the beginning of the book, some basic guiding principles for sustainable schooling. Could you talk about those? I think there's five basic guiding principles.
There are four that we especially attend to. And one of them is the idea that nature is our teacher. And we began to look at that a little bit already, that what you can learn when you observe nature, what you can learn about how humans relate to nature, as well as what you begin to do when you let nature be your teacher, everything from what makes healthy living, if you look at it from the perspective of nature, and so everything again from removal of chemical additives to just getting kids again into the natural world. I mean, some of the work that Richard Louv reports on and other people, that students actually are healthier, mentally healthier as well as physically healthier, even if they just have a window to look out. I mean, there's so many schools are built on that kind of penal institution model that it's all walls, and it's whether those walls are to keep the kids in or to keep the world out. It works both ways, and so just seeing nature, but of course much better getting into nature. And then when nature is our teacher, again, that requires us to think in terms of systems and to think in terms of relationships and to try to break down some of the fragmentation which we're so aware of. The second of those principles is sustainability is a community practice, and we mean all the words in that. That it's community. That's the way that we're going to sustain ourselves, is by working together, and it's practice. It's something that you do, you learn how to do, and you practice it. You do it over again, and so the part of what we're concerned with is how you can build community, how you can build community within a school. And how you can relate with the community surrounding you in such a way that you are Students are learning how to cooperate, learning how to tolerate differences, learning all the sorts of skills they're going to need if they're going to be successful in operating in the communities in which they're going to be living after they graduate. The third is the real world is the optimal learning environment. And again, a lot of that has to do with how do you not only pay attention to what you can do in a classroom, but how do you pay attention to what happens when you get out of the classroom? And again, that could be in nature, could be in an urban setting. Some very interesting stories, which we may want to talk about later, about civic engagement, where kids are involved in urban settings in helping improve the quality of life in their neighborhoods. Again, that's a real world sort of thing. Part of the notion, again, with the real world is that that's where we encounter things as they are, as students are going to have to work with them as they get older, so that, again, you get out of the kind of idealized sort of descriptions and see, well, what happens when decisions get made in a city council? What are the trade-offs? What are the kinds of things that go beyond this is what we think ought to happen to how do you make it happen? And so that happens only in the real world. And of course, the school can be the real world too. And so we don't exclude that. But I think that notion of finding things in their setting, which kind of points to the fourth principle, that sustainable living is rooted in a deep knowledge of place. And we seriously believe that that in order to live sustainable lives, you've got to understand the place where you live, and you've got to understand it well, and you've got to be able to relate to it. And of course, that's how we find that people fall in love with places, fall in love with natural places. They can also fall in love with an urban community, but that understanding, the getting beneath the kind of superficial level and really probing, which means often whether it's through an internship, whether it's through some kind of a service project, whether it's a civic engagement project of some sort, the people are beginning to understand what happens in places and how those places have evolved, that those places have a history, that those places have a culture, the natural world has a history, the civic world has a history, and that all of those kinds of things go into what it takes to understand something well enough to act effectively when you're working with it.
Well, let's go through some of those. Mm-hmm. One of the ones, of course, that you were talking about and I want to focus on is the whole area of food. Mm-hmm. And the importance of it. We have such an epidemic of obesity in this country, mm-hmm. and that relates to everything from healthcare to intelligence. One of the things that you had some great stories in there about mm-hmm. changing the food programs. Talk a little bit about the issue of food in schooling and education.
That's a good question. And in fact, some people are surprised when they find out that one of the four major sections of our book is food. In fact, we just were looking at some of the new material there. EcoSchools USA is through the National Wildlife Federation, has just begun its own program this year. And we looked, and food was not one of the areas that they considered. But we find that food is so critical for a lot of reasons. First, it's such an important and appropriate way to learn. It's something students haven't experienced immediately, always. It's an area where parents are concerned, and so there's a real opportunity for parent engagement. And food and agriculture are so important for energy use. They're important for certainly health. They're important for the well-being of local communities economically. So there's so many different directions that you can go with food. We got involved at the Center for Eco-Literacy because we had been funding programs, primarily garden programs, for some time, and some very nice programs. They're very successful programs. The Edible Schoolyard that Alice Waters started.
Yeah.
Some other programs, San Francisco and elsewhere. And then we were looking at how they were using those programs then to teach about nutrition. And that was very helpful, but we found out over and over again that what the kids were learning in those nutrition programs got undermined as soon as they walked into the cafeteria. That the very lessons they were being told weren't the lessons they were learning when they saw what the school actually believed through its actions. And so that got us involved with many of the people who are trying to change school food. And so the school food, again, becomes one of the areas which has a lot of immediacy. It's an area where you can talk about, again, cultural history, you can talk about art, you can talk about commerce, you can talk about agriculture, you can talk about transportation. And so it became, for us, an entree into looking at a lot of the kind of concerns that people have to have if they're going to be looking at what is it going to mean in the future to live sustainably.
You can look at it in so many different arenas, from civics to biology to mathematics to citizenship, whatever. You know, it does get into everything. One of the issues there, though, is there's such a small amount of money allocated to particularly public schools by the government. That's one of the problems, of course, in low-income areas. You know, you've got liquor stores selling most of the food, the same in schools. You've got such a small amount of money in some of these poorer schools. How do they make the shift? What do they do to be able to feed the better food?
And that's an excellent question. And what we found is that that's an obstacle almost everywhere. And that, again, what we wanted to report in the book was that there are people who are finding ways to address that question. I'll give you one example in Riverside, California. Rodney Taylor, who's the director of the food service there, had moved to Riverside. He had been the director in Santa Monica, Malibu, which is a rather well-to-do district. But he wanted the challenge of working in a much more difficult situation economically, where he didn't have as many parent volunteers. He didn't have the kind of PTA that could underwrite some of the programs that they had in Santa Monica. And when he got there, the first thing he realized was, people said, our enrollment is declining. How can we bring in the income we need? And so he said, the first thing we need to do, we're serving at this point 52% of the students in this district. If we can increase that, the increased income from that will in fact help us pay for what we want to do to expand. And especially he was interested in expanding with working with local farmers, with salad bars bought locally. And so through a very active kind of business attitude about the students are my customers, how do I attract these students, from everything from food tastings to bringing food to PTA meetings to giving teachers vouchers so they could eat and kids could see that teachers were eating in the cafeteria. That kind of thing was one way that he increased the income. Another thing he did, they discovered that, or he actually saw a newspaper article saying that the Meals on Wheels program in Riverside was in jeopardy because the purveyor of that program was raising the costs so much to the city. And he went to the superintendent of schools and said, we can be heroes and we can bring in some income if we became the supplier for the Meals on Wheels program. So they did that, and very successfully, and then that got them attention. Now various other community organizations are using the food service then, when it's not preparing food for children, to run their own programs. And so that's another kind of thing. It's a shame in some way that a school food system has to resort to those kinds of things. And and people are very aware that we need to spend more money on school food, that the school food authorization is being revoted on this fall. There's a lot of hope that it'll be increased, but this is not an economy in which people are very, very optimistic. We'll find out in the next couple of months. But so the people are finding ways. One of the very most interesting programs in the book is a program in Belfast, Maine, which is a garden-based program. Wonderful, wonderful ways that they've found. And another one of the obstacles people come to, and they say, you can run a program like the Lettable Schoolyard or something else. It'd be in California, of course, wonderful weather year-round. By building these student-built greenhouses, which they've found a way to manufacture for about $1,000 each with local materials, they can grow food year-round. So part of every meal for those kids in Maine, whether it's 10 degrees below zero or warm
weather. It really gets cold there, too, to
really
be producing in the winter.
But they can do it, and so every meal they have some fresh food. One of the other things that they do then, they grow enough food through this that they create businesses, and they sell food at the local co-op, some of the produce. They collect seeds. They do seed saving. They sell the seeds by by mail order, but then they also use every part of that is also part of the education program.
Yes, I was thinking that, part of the curriculum.
Because it's part of the curriculum when they're doing the seed saving, they're understanding the agricultural history of their region, when they're and they do it in very much that sense of cooperation. Before they ever began selling food in the co-op, they went around and they talked with the local farmers and said, well, what are you growing? Because we don't intend to compete with you. So they found some crops, produce that the school district was importing from California, was importing from the South, but they could grow there. So they sell that. And as a result of all of that, that garden program, very wonderful garden program, is self-supporting. So you have that kind of an approach, a different sort of approach in Davis, California in 2007 after a lot of effort over several years, a group of which had begun as a group of mothers and parents got behind a parcel tax for the citizens actually voted to tax themselves partly to buy more food for the school food system. And so again, there are a lot of different kinds of creative ways. And ideally, and I think we support everybody's effort to increase the federal allocations. It's not enough. But we're also finding that people are not willing to say, well, because that money isn't enough, we give up. We can't do it.
Right. They're finding alternatives.
Finding alternatives. And one of the alternatives, unfortunately, the schools have found, and this has been historic, is selling a la carte food, basically junk food. I mean, whether it's in the cafeteria or in a student store or something, they sell high calorie, high salt, all of those kinds of things, and kids buy it.
Kids like it. I'm wondering how you particularly people who were raised on fast food, mm-hmm. how do you start to shift them to natural, organic, balanced diet?
One of the things that we discover is a couple of things. One of them is that when kids actually get exposed to fresh food, many of them have never eaten anything fresh. Many of them don't have a good concept, as you were mentioning earlier. Food does come out of dirt, and carrots grow out of the ground. Potatoes are roots, and they grow on underground. And so this is all a discovery for them. But they also just discover that when they eat a fresh tomato, when they eat fresh greenery, when they cook it, which is also part of many garden programs, many school programs, they'll try it and they'll like it. And often, to parents' enormous amazement, they'll come home and say, "Gosh, could we buy kale?" Parents are not prepared to find out that kids are willing and often eager to eat fresh food when they're exposed to it. Another kind of thing that happens is in Richland, South Carolina, there was the school board was confronted with what looked like a fairly lucrative contract for sodas on a soda machine. Again, one of those real problems, a real scandal, is how much the soft drink manufacturers have been subsidizing, and you could probably say bribing in some cases, school districts to install their machines. And so they had this contract coming up, and the superintendent of schools just said, "I've looked at this, and student health is not for sale. No soda machines." But then they went further than that and said, "Well, what about all this other unhealthy food that we're serving a la carte?" And thinking, we can't afford not to do that. And they said, "Okay, we're going not to do that." And so they lost, I think, the first year, $275,000 in a la carte sales. But what happened was when the kids didn't have that option, they bought the regular lunch. And so, in fact, over the course of the first year, they brought in $50,000 more than they had the previous year.
Yeah.
So another one of those ways that the economics can work, but there are a lot of
don't give them a choice.
Don't give them a choice. And if you can not give them a choice in a way that you're also teaching about what healthy food is, and you're giving them the opportunity, I think you have to do taste tests. You have to be very attentive to what kids will and won't eat, and be willing to adjust. But they find out that kids will often eat the good food. They'll sometimes come to prefer it, and so it can be done. But it's not a simple kind of thing, and there are a lot of assumptions that, you know, the assumption that kids are addicted to fast food, the assumption that we can't afford to lose the income from the a la carte food. All of those sort of things are things that, again, partly what we're trying to do in the book is give enough examples of places that have challenged some of those assumptions and challenged them successfully.
Talk to us about ecological accounting.
Ecological accounting. One of, again, for me, most interesting stories in the book, the most fulfilled example of that is a school, Northfield Mount Hermon School in Massachusetts. And what they did, they decided to do an ecological audit where they really sat down and over the course of a year, more than a year, they looked at everything the school does. They looked at, literally, they measured how much energy do we use, where does the energy come from. They measured where our water comes from, how much of it comes from the Connecticut River, how much of it comes from aquifers, how much of it do we recycle or don't we recycle, what are all the kinds of ways, what are the chemicals that are used in the school labs, what are the chemicals used in the art department, and began to just do a complete accounting of everything they do that has some impact on the environment, with the idea that then they would set themselves some targets for how they wanted to improve that. And so, what again, they did this accounting. They wrote a very extensive report on that, which is available on their website. And then they began to set some targets. They set some baselines, and then they said, this is what we want to do in 5 years. This is what we want to do in 10 years. So they really wanted to not only to have some kind of philosophical notions, well, we'd like to do better, but to try to measure it, to try to say, what are we actually doing right now, and what are the areas, what would it mean if we increased by 20% the amount of fresh food that we're serving in the cafeteria? What would it mean if we used water out of the Connecticut River rather than water from the municipal water system to irrigate the campus, to run the plumbing system, and so on? And so they did a very careful and extensive kind of job, which of course then also became very educational for the students who were involved in it.
I don't know that there's anything that we do that doesn't impact the ecology, either one way or another. You know, I have to say, just an aside, when I read your book, I literally was in tears, thinking, oh, what would it have been like to go to a school like this? You know, that wasn't how I was brought up and raised at all.
No, it wasn't how I was either. And they were asking questions that would have occurred to me to ask when I was that age, or for my teachers to ask.
Yeah, it's amazing. Let's talk, you mentioned a little bit, but it's so important, such an important issue. I'd like you to expand on it. And it's the idea of the relationship between education and cultivating community. I think that's, you know, one of the things that our show is hoping to do is to heal some of the breaks in the community, and because we are going to really need community soon. So let's just talk about that, how that's emerging in this smart by nature concept that you
right.
have.
And I think a couple of ways. One of them is by paying attention to the school community. Some of the schools we talked about, Marin Academy in San Rafael here in California, created an eco-council in which not only are there students and teachers, but parents, board members, members of the administration, and they began to take responsibility for looking at, again, almost like at Northfield Mount Hermon, what's everything we do and how can we do it better by our own criteria.
Kind of a systems audit.
And again, I think part of what we were, the reason we did the book was not only to look at the good things you can do, but to try to talk about how do you do them? What are the kinds of ways that are needed to make a community work? And so in this case, little sorts of things that make a big difference. The head of school at the time appointed important members of her administration, the business manager, the facilities manager, to that committee so that it was a voluntary committee, but she wanted to make sure that the administration was well represented and that decisions that got made, recommendations, were really being heard, and that important parts of the administration who are going to have to act on them were part of those decisions. So I think that's it. The notion of including everybody, one of the key things that happens over and over again is that certain people get left out of decisions. They tend to be often the people who are not regarded as well, the food service staff, the custodial staff. I mean, people will create whole recycling programs and not talk with the custodians about where you're going to put the trash cans. Certainly not talk with the custodians about, if we do this, this is how your job's going to change. This is how you may have to do something you weren't doing before. Same thing with the food service. Often going to fresh food means that shifting from heating something to cooking something, to cooking from scratch. All of those kinds of things become important parts of the change, but they require the participation of people who have sometimes, as they will, they'll say, nobody's ever asked me before. Nobody's ever said, how is this going to impact you and your job? So I think that kind of sense of community.
It's like the stakeholders. You need to know who all the stakeholders are
right. When
you look down the line from everything.
Exactly.
Now.
And John Muir, another school here in Berkeley, found out that when they were going to make some major changes in their food service and their cleanup, their recycling, they said, well, we'll talk about it at a staff meeting. And they realized then, nobody had ever noticed before, staff meetings were scheduled at a time when only teachers could come. And so they began to say, oh, this is going to require a bigger change than just we want to change the food. If we're going to get the cooperation and collaboration of the whole staff, we've got to pay attention to whether they can come to our meetings. So that became a bigger change than maybe they had expected. Mm-hmm. The other piece about community that's important is how the school relates to the surrounding community. I think there are a lot of places now that people are doing service learning, and I think all of that is important and very valuable often. But to move a step further into the term that people are using, civic engagement, where you're not only involved in, say, doing visits at a rest home or something else, but you're involved in issues that are important to the people in your community. In one of the most interesting stories in the book is in Burlington, Vermont, where a program called Healthy Neighborhoods, Healthy Kids began. And this is third graders. I mean, you're not talking about hugely sophisticated kids, but one of the things that they did in that program was they understood sustainability as improving the quality of life for everyone and by implication for all living things, not just for people, for now and for the future. And so they began to say, well, what would quality of life look like in our neighborhood? What would be the indicators if we went into a neighborhood and wanted to see it? And they came up with actually a pretty sophisticated list of everything from more green space to removal of graffiti to places where people can hang out, to how do you get neighbors together, to the fact that they realized there was no traffic sign in front of their school, so the school was actually in a dangerous place. And it was in one of the poorer neighborhoods in the city, and had, again, a neighborhood which had been used to being neglected. So they went out, they set these indicators, and then they went out, walked around, and did report cards on their neighborhood. They came back then, and then they delivered those report cards to the city officials, to the city council, and then began to talk about, well, what can we do to improve some of the things in this community? And the city council took some of those recommendations. They said, well, we've got to put a traffic sign up there. So they did that. But they also, the kids organized wildlife habitation restoration so they could bring birds into the city. They organized block parties just to get neighbors together. So all of those kinds of things then became parts of, again, something being done in a school in a poor district, involved in the community and involved in making life better for the people in their community. And in the course of that, the school became a more visible place. It became a place where people were responding, seeing it as a resource. And then just last year, the school board decided to make that school a sustainability academy for the whole district. So all of those kinds of things which came out of this sense of what do we do in a community and how do we find out who the resources are in the community who can make the decisions to improve things in a way that's going to be good over the long term for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Of course, one of the big issues in schools is the latchkey problem. Do you find that, you know, there are parents who are working two jobs just to make ends meet? I mean, each parent working, but some of them working more than one job. Do you find that in any way can this help get more involvement from the parents? Because that's such an important issue in education.
It seems to, in several different kinds of ways. In the school in Burlington, then they began to do some community dinners, and parents who had not been part of the school were showing up. They were realizing that the school cared about their kids. They were realizing it cared about their neighborhood, that they wanted to do things more in the community. And so they found that they were, in fact, getting more involved than they had been before. And again, it was a scheduling kind of thing where they had to find, often did sessions in evenings and so on when parents weren't so available. Another whole kind of way, going back to food, that's happened is that some places have very successfully integrated people, often immigrant populations, but other people too, to come in and teach the kids about culture through food and to share some of their recipes. And what they've found then is the impact of that is that those parents not only are providing a kind of service, but they're getting more involved in the schools, then they're becoming part of the community. They're becoming part of the PTAs. And so those kinds of things, they do happen. There are a lot of challenges, but I think it's that paying attention and saying we really do want you to be part of what we're doing, and so we'll schedule it in a way that you can be part of it.
Right. That has a lot to do with it. One of the things about kids, you know, they want it to be cool. And there's a story in your book here about the cool school. Do people really, when they start doing this, it's a little bit different? Do their friends give them a hard time? Oh, you're eating sprouts or kale and give them a hard time. How does it begin to be cool to be in a natural environment and learning for sustainability?
I think part of it is that it's, This is the kids get involved and the other students see that they're enjoying it, that when students are beginning to do this. Another thing very specifically, though, is that people are realizing that sometimes they need to identify who are the cool kids and help those students become parts of the leading. So that if they're talking about revising the food service, for instance, one of the key kinds of things is getting some of the kids who are looked at by the other kids to be the ones who are the proponents of the program, who are part of the marketing, to use that term, of the program to the other kids. I think that makes a difference. Another program, this actually was partly came out of Northfield Mount Hermon, also in Vermont, as well as a school in New Jersey and a school in New Hampshire, the Green Cup Challenge, which was a competition among the schools to see who could, over the period of a one-month period, reduce their electricity use the most. And part of what they did, and of course, part of the kids just got right into it because it's competition, it was fun, their friends were doing it. But partly, again, they went out of their way to try to identify who are the student leaders, who are the kids who, if they are seen at the forefront of this, other
everyone
people
don't
want
it.
To.
Yeah.
And so they just take that natural kind of social arrangement among kids and try to take advantage of it.
Mm. I think where I'd like to go, Michael, in this conversation, to share with people what we can do. At one point, there are five steps in this one, I think. Mm-hmm. You have a list of steps people can do, but a lot of times people listen and they say, well, that's really nice, but we try on conversations to leave people in action. So what can our listeners do, whether they have children or not? They certainly are concerned about the future. People who listen to this show are concerned about the future for all life on this planet. So what can we do?
We can do a number of things. I think people can get involved. One of the first things you talk about are this five-step process that we outline. And one of the first things, parts of that, the step one in that process, is look around and find out who else might be interested. I think one of the hardest things for anybody to do, especially with institutions as entrenched as schools can be, is to try to do it alone. And so who are the people, and it could be the school nurse, it could be teachers, often as students, could be an administrator. Who are the other people who might be interested? Who are the community people who could be interested? And find out who those people are and begin to reach a kind of agreement with each other. We're going to work on this, and we're going to give it some time. I mean,
it's really starting with community building.
It's starting with community building. And in some organizations I know, very successful organizations, spent the first year community building before they tried to change anything. Sometimes that can move more quickly. I think the other thing to do is to identify what are the areas that you're concerned about. Is it school food? Is it school use of resources? Is it recycling? And pick an area. And again, find out who's responsible at the school for that area and go talk with them. I mean, one of the things that happens a lot with food service, for instance, is that food service directors are just used to having people complain. They say, the food's bad, it's terrible, and they become defensive about it. And people often don't understand the constraints that they're working under, that some of what the food service director has to face is federal regulations or it's finances. Or it's something else. And so to talk with those administrators and say, see it from their perspective. What is it that they could do? And then find ways to work with them. And sometimes you're going to end up, as some people have found out, in confrontation. And sometimes it becomes a political kind of thing. But often administrators are more than happy to work with people who come to them and say, how can we help you do what we both want to do, rather than, here's what you ought to do, here's what's wrong with what's going on. So I think that those couple of things, I think certainly at a legislative level, I think all the support that people can give to urging Congress to do a better job of appropriating money for school lunch, for instance, I mean, that because that bill is up for reauthorization, that's important. I think letting school boards know that you want to see changes. I mean, parents can be very influential with school boards, with superintendents. I know one California school district where they made a big decision, spent a lot of money building green, and part of the reason they said was the school board heard from parents, this is what we want. We're parents, we're taxpayers, and we want you to do this. And that helped swing them to deciding, well, we probably better do it then. So I think that there are ways that people can influence. I think people can just begin by finding out what's going on. If you're a parent or if you're an involved citizen, go and have lunch at the school. Find out what they really are eating. Find out are you satisfied with it? What would a better lunch look like for you? What's going on, and then find out who it is that's responsible for making those changes and become an ally of that person, become somebody who's willing to work with them. And I think those kinds of things do begin to make a difference.
It's so easy to point the finger to our political leaders, mm-hmm. and yet, it's the same thing on the macro level, right. too, when you think about our horrible showing in the world, mm-hmm. with 4.5% of the population creating 36% of the pollution. But you can't blame it on the political leaders if the people haven't stood up and said, exactly. this is what we want. And it's the same in education, too.
I think so. And it's the same in education right now. And the reason why we wrote a book like Smart by Nature, and the reason we're concerned with schools is who are going to be the citizens a generation from now who are also going to have to be making those decisions. I think that the citizenry has a lot of clout, but it has to exercise it. Political leaders get the will to do things when they find out that that's what the voters want them to do. And as you realize that a third grader is going to be voting in 10 years, and so you right now you're building perhaps the constituency to make the changes that you can't make right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, we were talking about organizing, envisioning, planning, reflecting. Mm-hmm. What did we get to the last part there?
I think the last of the five steps, and this goes along with our idea that nature is our teacher, is that nature works in cycles. Nature works in feedback loops. Right. And so the last step is to pay attention to what you've learned, to see how it changes what you can do the next time around. And then to look at that as a kind of spiral of We'll make some changes now. We'll see their effect, and then we'll learn from them, and then we'll keep at it. I think the persistence is critical. People, again, the Davis example, where the people who started that, Ann Evans, who was a former mayor of Davis, one of the parent leaders of this food revolution there, said, I was part of the setting up of the co-op here in Davis and the farmer's market. So that took 10 years to do. We're going to give this one 10 years, which was important both because people got into it with a realization we're in this for the long term, and it was important because the school district knew that they were working with people who weren't going to go away the first time they got discouraged. So I think that understand that if the changes are big enough, school districts are very slow to change often. They're designed in some ways to be slow to change. They're designed to conserve values. And so to understand that this might take time, but to begin to identify, well, what are the steps we can take that we can succeed at so that we're not going to go away when it doesn't change overnight, but we're going to be able to identify some things we can accomplish that we can celebrate, we can feel good about, that that'll help us attract other people who want to become part of this change, and then keep a record of what you've done, why you did it, what happened with it, so that the next time when it does come around again, you can learn from it. Mm.
Michael, I just want to thank you very much for the years and years of heartfelt service and commitment that you've brought to the education system. And from that place, that big heart of yours, is there anything that you'd like to just say as a closing remark to the people who are listening to this show about what they can do for education? And we've talked about that, but mm-hmm. I mean, just any last words that you'd like to share with people?
I think get involved, and as you said, work from your heart. It's not just a mind thing. It's not just a, you know, what are your passions? What are the things you really want to see that deeply matter to you, that matter enough that you're going to make them an important part of your life, and that you're going to find other people who want to do that too, and become a community and work together, and change can happen.
Yeah, I've often seen that whatever people are passionate about, there's a need somewhere mm-hmm. at the heart of that passion. There's a need for that. So, well, thank you for your passion and for your work. Again, we've been talking to Michael K. Smith, the new book. So I'm trying to change your name because it's the same of mine. Again, we've been talking to Michael K. Stone from the Center for Eco-Literacy. The book is Smart by Nature, Schooling for Sustainability. Thank you all for listening, and thank you, Michael, for your work and your wisdom.
Well, thank you.
Conversations is an independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5, Nevada City, and listener contributions. We are committed to bringing you leading-edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at rewelistening.net.